Our early afternoon panel is comprised of executives representing three highly regarded service providers who offer cloud-based services to the media and entertainment sector. We've already met each one of them, so let's begin with this question. From your perspectives, where are we seeing the greatest inroads for cloud-based solutions in pre-production before content is already created? Also, is it in collaboration, for example, in casting, script writing, location scouting, financial planning? Where do you see cloud solutions making inroads in the front end of content creation? Let's start with Brian.
Ultimately, I think all of those are applicable. You know, from my perspective, of course, I think that the casting, the staffing, the financial planning, project planning, all of that stuff that at some way, shape, or form, a lot of us have been doing in the cloud for some time, whether they were sort of IT clouds in the back of our facilities. More recently, cloud-based services, you know, Evernote, I know, is a big service that a lot of people use on the creative side to share notes and collaborate. The heavier stuff is probably more of the challenge. So when you're talking about actually, you know, field shooting, field acquisition, in fact, we're part of a group called the ETC, Entertainment Technology Community. It's based out of Hollywood, where all the major studios are participants, as well as some key vendors. And the idea there is sort of a think tank for enabling these type of workflows and solving some of the challenges that we're seeing. And one of the biggest initiatives that we're working on is exactly that. So you have a field production team, they're out shooting in rural Louisiana. How do they get the dailies back? How do they get the 4K high-res raw footage back to facility? How can they interoperate? How can they protect that data? So the idea is throwing an intern into a car and finding the local 7-Eleven, Starbucks, or a data center demark point, uploading those through predefined, you know, demarcation into these cloud-based services now that are private, you know, in our perspective, maybe even tying into solutions like this where the dailies are then being turned around and delivered back out to the producers and the executive teams as well in a secured fashion. It's not something that's easy today. I mean, it's easy if you're sitting in the middle of Hollywood and you have these big, huge pipes like, you know, the Disneys and the NBC Universals do, but it's not an easy thing. So a lot of people are using, you know, the S3s or Azures for collaboration and production workflows, but it's transient storage. It's not a long-term eventuality. So they use that for the production. They use that for what it's worth through some, you know, hack together security infrastructure or through service providers that layer on top. And then as soon as that production is done, they figure out how to download that, you know, 500 or 700 terabytes worth of data and where to store it in their infrastructure. So it is a lot of transient stuff going up and down, leveraging cloud-based transcoding, production-based, unfortunately, because a lot of the way that the financing is handled on productions is it's per production. So nobody on the back end is investing in huge infrastructures and staffing to come up with ubiquitous rules across the enterprise. It's just piecemeal solutions where people are trying to hack together things that they can, and some of them are embracing the cloud and some of them aren't.
Okay. Jason, do you want to add to that?
That's pretty much right on. I mean, we see it for scripts and for some of the basic easy stuff as pre-production side of things, but when it comes to the video, almost nothing really hits the cloud these days just because of the sheer volume of content that needs to flow through the systems and the problems with bandwidth and the fact that it's separate productions that are spun up, spun down really quickly. Very limited long-term view planning on that side.
Okay. David?
There's not a whole ton to add to that. I think a little bit on, you know, more on the pre side as well. We're seeing, you know, greater use and interest in mobile application usage to whether it be scouting, whether it be, you know, doing short video clip from the creative process, being able to easily share, collaborate on that stuff, as well as things such as interactivity and collaboration when it comes to storyboarding and so forth, making those more cloud-based and interactive and distributed, and drawing that all into that mobile experience. So, hey, I can do now more from my tablet and so forth in a cloud shared environment, but from the video perspective, it's already been covered well.
Yeah.
Now, Brian already kind of touched on this, but the second question is, moving along in the file-based workflow process for content creation, where are cloud solutions coming into use for production?
Is it in shearing dailies, preparing logs, or in the business functions ancillary to the actual shooting of scenes, such as the accounting and finance side? Let's begin with Jason.
Yeah, very similar to last one. The business function side of things is pretty well established already, and low bandwidth is still easy to use. We are starting to see an uptick of use of solutions like ours for dailies distribution. But even for a solution like ours, which is entirely public cloud and not the private cloud kind of stuff that Brian's company works with, we still require essentially proxy versions of the masters to come down, right? I mean, you can't expect to upload multiple hundreds of gigabytes of video on a daily basis, unless you're uploading a smaller version of it to us, or you have another method to get that to us. So in reality, it's kind of the same as where we were before.
David?
And I think one of the things that we've seen a bit of interest in ways to extend upon that as well is how can we integrate a live workflow into some of that as well, or near live workflow. So whether it's taking that production content that's going on, either directly feeding it through or shortly after in the form of the dailies, you know, whether it can turn into essentially as a, like a live form proxy, being able to publish that, being able to have more distributed workforce or other people in remote locations being able to take a part in that. Offers great new collaboration basis for how we can integrate with the cloud for the actual production level of information going on. And then from there, that can then facilitate utilizing the more traditional methods of just, you know, lower bit rate or lower, data flow of being able to add in data, whether it's adding in notes, commenting, collaboration on top of that, and being able to tag that in the metadata perspective of what's going on in that event and the situation at hand for the production.
And Brian?
Yeah, I think maybe one of the points touched on in our presentations was the challenge is the status quo, right? So, I mean, you're talking about a paradigm shift where, the truth of the matter are interns are cheap and they'll work like monkeys. And when that one doesn't work like a monkey, you get rid of that monkey and you get a different monkey. There's people like that, want to cut their teeth in the industry. And, why embrace big expense, big challenges, and potentially risk? The Nirvanic story that everybody knows about, why embrace that risk if you don't have to, if the status quo kind of works okay? So, I think when we launched our private cloud service, we already had at some level the trust of most of these major media organizations because they were using our systems on-prem. It was 2 years ago, and we thought we'd have to sort of cut our teeth with some of the smaller media organizations first, but our first two customers were Disney and Warner Brothers, so we were very, very fortunate that way. But, we sort of expected this to be a no-brainer, and the uptake is, like I said, it's about 5% of our content now after 2 years of a service. So predominantly, we're talking about, 950 petabytes of data on-prem in these big, heavy iron things, and 50 petabytes in these cloud services or cloud nodes around the world. So, I think proxies are a big key to this. So I think right now, because the pipes getting up and down are not necessarily as big as everybody would like, although they're much, much cheaper than they were even just as recent as last year, being able to bring things in and transcode them on the fly, so you're bringing, especially when you're dealing now with 4K, if you can bring that back and turn it around in some semblance of real time and start pushing out dailies to people's iPads and iPhones as they're going back and forth in their car service or on the train, it's a big value proposition. And over time, the idea is offloading the high resolution, keeping it in these private or public cloud, whatever the right solution is for the media or the content owner, and making better and better tools for them to be creative, not necessarily worry about the back-end infrastructures.
Okay, this is going to be a little bit redundant here, but I have my list of questions I've already gave me, okay? So turning now to post-production, where do you see cloud-based solutions being used? Is it mostly animation, or is it now in live-action scene editing? The application of metadata, and where is the cloud playing the biggest part? Let's start with David.
I mean, the cloud plays its part in kind of a couple ways. I mean, from the editing perspective, the cloud's playing its part in the form of being able to access that content quickly, be able to get that content down, whether it be in full form or more likely in a proxy realm, being able to distribute that job across multiple people who want to work with it. Cloud-based, you know, editing from a consumer perspective, you know, also has some interesting implications and value, and is also seeing further growth, especially in the social media realms, but less in obviously the large scale professional realm. But you know, I think a key one that is continuing and going forward is things like metadata and what you can do with that, the tagging, the ancillary data that can really add great value for the lifetime after that point for that content that you're working with. That's where you can get you know, amazing collaboration and easier use with this, and you know, you're not necessarily pushing the petabytes too hard at that point.
Brian, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think I totally agree. I think ultimately, if you rewound the clock, maybe you know 6, 7, 8 years ago, the bulk of studio productions were done on film. There was only so much film that you can produce in a day. So ultimately, to get that turned around, scan it, do the dailies, get them back out to distribution, it was a very, very heavy process. Now, all the cameras, RED and whatever else, are either hard drives or SSD cards, and they're shooting whether there's anything going on or not. So the amount of raw content and the size of that data has grown exponentially just in the last 5 years. So being able to manage and find that content, and so metadata is a key part. And we're actually, interestingly enough, we have a parallel initiative within the ISR communities here in the US, and we're working on a proof of concept for metadata mining of content. And ultimately what it is using machines to be able to detect genders, faces, patterns, you know, license plate numbers, and the project we're working on is with the FBI. And the sort of the use case was the Boston Marathon bombing. And so within, you know, 24 hours, they had 8,000 hours of video coming in from people's cell phones, from surveillance cameras, you know, police videos, interviews. And, you know, they mobilized every single agent domestically and otherwise. And there was no way they could even come close to watching that content to find out points of interest. So just by chance, they found that pattern about, you know, baseball cap and backpack. Then they were able to go in and use time references now to look across. So once they've triaged now, they can go back in and look for that portion of data coming from other video and video sources. So if you can use machines to help doing that initial triage, and as those machines get better, the analysis gets better. And the same thing applies in media and entertainment. So the more information that you have that you can search by, not just, you know, camera number 3, oh, that was the wrong camera, let's go to camera number 4. But, you know, most cameras now, they have accelerometers, GPS data, so you can actually map out where the camera was pointing at any particular moment in time. Time code data, universal time references, GPS coordinates. So even just taking that information, the amount of accessible content has grown significantly.
Jason?
From our perspective on the post-production side, it's the biggest challenge is more about how do you show the right piece of content to the right person and ensure that the wrong people aren't allowed to see it. And we get constant requests for a list of user access, which of these 5 people were allowed to see this video because this one, you know, senior executive or lawyer is asking about it. So I don't think the industry is caught up to kind of the vision you're painting on that side, at least from the, when we talk about the business to individual, which is kind of the section I covered. But, you know, for us, for what we see, it's still very much about, like, how do you get the right content to the right person? You think we would have moved on past that, but we're still there.
So, once a motion picture, television program, episode, or music track is a finished product, it needs to be transcoded for an increasing number of digital formats to play on the various platforms. How are cloud solutions helping that and related aspects? Brian?
Sure. For those of you who have involved with this industry at any level, you know that, and I mean, I'm sure that you know as well, these solutions have been around forever, and in fact, a lot of them are almost commoditized now. The interesting point is that we're having a hard time convincing these content owners and content producers to embrace private or public cloud for their, you know, long-term storage and archiving, because they say, well, we don't want to put our stuff in the cloud. But the truth of the matter is they've been putting their stuff in the cloud for 5 years now. I mean, when did iTunes launch? When did Netflix launch? When all of that content is on cloud platforms, at CDNs, that the customers or the content owners have very, very little control of, right? Yeah. Bugs in the CDN software makes content go places that you don't know where it is. And it could be sitting at an edge cache somewhere and somebody could have access to that and you wouldn't even know it. There's no real audit trails or anything like that. So, you know, there's online publishing platforms. We work with one called The Platform, which is a Comcast solution. There's Brightcove. Obviously, you know, these guys have solutions like that that are either delivering to smaller audiences or delivering potentially out to larger audiences as well through different platforms. So there's a lot of solutions out there. You know, maybe they're better to answer, but it's just kind of, it's interesting to me when we go in and we're meeting with these high-level content owners and media organizations, and they're so adverse to the cloud, and meanwhile, they're embracing, the other department that sits in the room beside them has been embracing the cloud for 5 years.
Jason?
Yeah, transcoding is hugely valuable when it's done in the cloud, because of the burst nature of transcoding. You'll get a video and then you'll need to create 10, 15, 20 versions of it. The ability to dynamically spin up a server to handle each one of those variations and spin it down when you're done is hugely valuable. So from that perspective, it's been great. But the other thing we're seeing too, though, is when you consider the early days of the smartphone, the number and types of variations you would have to produce grew very quickly. At one point, we were producing probably 20 to 30 different variations for the small subset of use cases we do. But now that you're seeing vendors consolidate and certain vendors are winning in these in the consumer side of things, like Apple and Samsung, the number of variations you have to produce has been decreasing. And we expect new technologies like Dash to even consolidate that even more. So from a transcoding perspective, it's actually getting easier, which is pretty nice.
But how about the metadata challenges around that?
Yeah, we don't have to deal with that stuff on our side.
Yay, time code. I think you guys hit it spot on for the most part. And I think the only thing to add is, you know, there also is starting, because it's been so valuable and it's being used a ton from a cloud-based perspective for the transcoding because of it makes sense. I want something scalable. I need to be able to burst this. This works really well. The challenge from a technical perspective historically, though, has been, well, with transcoding systems before, a lot of that where they saw a major benefit and so forth were things from like the GPU perspective and so forth. That has been a bit lacking. It's been really trailing a little bit in the cloud-based perspective. Yeah. That's starting to be addressed. So now we can even see greater levels of performance increase in the cloud. Amazon's got some really cool stuff going. Google's got some cool things in the works as well that are going to be able to start leveraging some of the more technology that's been out there for a little while, but just hasn't worked as well as it could be on the cloud. So this isn't going to change, although it's improving, just like Jason said, because, hey, we're starting to see consolidation both off of platform, but also, to some degree, we're seeing it just in bandwidth. You know, as mobile devices are generally lifting up in the bandwidth that they can handle, we don't have to do necessarily as many you know, bit rates of that same content as well. We can start trying to focus more on that higher quality and so forth. But you know, it's going to be a major benefit, major player for quite some time and for the future within the cloud. And it's growing in its technical capabilities as well.
Okay. Now, this is what I want to know. We certainly hear the most about storage in the cloud. What insights can you share with us about the state of adoption of cloud-based storage for entertainment and media? Jason?
I'll speak from my perspective, and I'm sure Brian will have a very strong opinion on this as well. From our perspective, storage is the best use case. The kinds of technology that's layered into the public cloud side of things means it's one less thing that a vendor like us has to worry about. So Amazon, for example, which is where all of our stuff is based, Amazon S3 supports supports encryption and REST with Amazon-hosted keys that they rotate every, call it 90 days, automatically. I mean, that amount of technology to build that and for us to build and support it as a vendor would, it's an incredible amount of work we would have to do to support that level of it. And to be able to have Amazon just do it for us with the switch of a flag, is an amazing benefit for us. So we're very happy about the approach. Oh, and the fact that Amazon dropped their prices by 80% in the last year has been pretty nice, too.
The benefit of scalable storage speaks to itself. You know, the challenge that we see in the media to some degree is sometimes getting content there, getting content out of there. You know, it simply just due to the nature of HTTP and what that happens with there. There are solutions, growing ones and mature ones, that help deal with that, and therefore it helps really reduce that factor. But the varied options that are there are tremendous and incredibly viable. When we're talking about live workflows and at scale, you know, we do have challenges of also I/O speeds and so forth that we might have to consider. Whether that really falls under the storage umbrella as much or as other issues is maybe somewhat debatable, but there's a solution for that. All the cloud providers have option for that. You might not get the same cost benefit that you have with your midterm, long-term storage, but you know, without a doubt, that's, I think, one of been a major selling point from day one of why we can take media to the cloud is that it's scalable, it's large, better protection options are coming every day to some degree, and it's very cost effective.
Brian.
Yeah, so it's kind of in our sweet spot, I guess. But I guess ultimately, even though, and as Jason pointed out, that Amazon's dropped their prices, but the truth of the matter is if you're looking at, you know, a couple hundred terabytes for 3 or 4 months, it's not that big of a deal, the cost that you have to bear. But, you know, if you're looking at models where you're talking about 5, 10, 20 petabytes of data replicated, so, you know, the SLAs that are the baseline SLAs are non-replicated, you're going to be hitting that because you want to do data at rest authentication to make sure that the content is still viable. You know, you're talking exponential growth of your costs. And if you have an infrastructure in-house, on-prem, you probably have a couple staff already working there doing other things that can you can sort of say are more or less free to manage the infrastructure. The cost might be additional data tapes and maybe Iron Mountain shelf storage. So the carrying cost of housing thing in the cloud, even some of the more economically beneficial ones, is still significant when you're talking about large collections. You know, our Link service prices out at scale at about 1 penny per gig per month, which is sort of in line almost exactly with what Glacier charges. But we're talking about SLAs that include replicated content, so 100% durability guarantee, you know, 5, 6, 9s uptime guarantees, seconds to data, not hours to data. I don't know if you know that, but it's 5 hours minimum time to first byte in Glacier to access your data. And it has to be kind of accessed through either API or through S3. It's just that you can't do that. You can't have that in an active archive environment. Now, if you want it as a deep vault, that's one thing, but you know, you can't wait 5 hours for a you know, 1 minute news clip to start downloading so you can put a story on the 11 o'clock news. So, you know, you really need to be cognizant of those type of things, what type of environment. If you're a very, very rich broadcaster and you want to store everything in S3, when you're in the few petabytes, I mean, you're talking $20,000 or $50,000 a month just to have the data stored there. And that's one copy. So, you know, over time, as your archives grow and you want to preserve that content, you could be looking at expenses of, I mean, you know, OPEX, but millions of dollars a year to be able to carry that. So, you know, you need, as I mentioned during my presentation, you need to figure all of this out, build that Excel spreadsheet. We have tools on our website that'll help you estimate some of this, but do the thinking up front. Think about what your data growth is going to look like. When are you going to launch 4K production? Are you going to acquire a bunch of, you know, historical archives of 50 or 100,000 videotapes or films? How are you going to digitize those? How are you going to preserve those? You need to think about that before you enter into these environments, because if you enter into that environment, you have this carrying cost. And after your bills reach, you know, $500,000 or $1 million a year, what do you do to disconnect from that service? Well, you spend another $1 million building an infrastructure on-prem, and then you wait 5 years to download all that data across a network connection that's costing you a couple hundred grand a year. So think about the entrance and think about the exit and make sure that you understand all the costs that are involved.
Yeah. And this is somewhat redundant as well, but go ahead and ask it. Using the cloud as a centerpiece for delivery to end users is also becoming more prevalent. What can you tell us about how cloud-based entertainment content delivery is progressing? David.
So that kind of depends on how you also determine, you know, what that delivery means. So where we work a lot is going to be kind of that end-user delivery for whether it be premium content or so forth. In that regard, you know, the cloud is still progressing and still growing in what options to have, whether it be utilizing services like CloudFront, which try to do a lot of that for you, or building your own infrastructure in both that public-private type of situation, in which case, you know, utilizing things like a media server, Wowza, Adobe Media Server, so forth, helping you do the packaging to get that out there so you can maintain your content in its kind of original form and deal with it in that regard. And then also, you know, adding in layers of DRM protection and so forth on the fly can be really viable from what you can do from the delivery side of things. You know, either way, that becomes a critical point because, you know, if you're going to be judged on your content and in part, how does that play back, the delivery becomes a critical factor. And the cloud, distributed model, multiple regions, all these things kind of come into play to really help provide that better experience in getting that content, you know, once it's been wonderfully produced and collaborated on and so forth, out to you know, actually be viewed and used.
Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, I think once you, I mean, the transcoding in the cloud, I think, is key to the deliverables. So, you know, I think if you asked any media organization, they would tell you today that still greater than, I don't know what the exact number is this month, but still greater than 90% of their revenue comes from linear terrestrial broadcast and carriage of their content. So even though the customers are demanding that they want the content on their YouTube, their OTT platforms, on their mobile phones, it's not where the money's coming from. So there's still the bread and butter, which is the linear terrestrial stuff, heavy metal based, you know, servers and, you know, BNC connectors and transmitters and satellite encoders and things like that. To be honest, that was and continues to be the hardest thing. So even though we're dealing with all of these formats and transcoding and wrappers and metadata packaging and CDNs and, you know, CloudFront or whatever else, these services, still the bread and butter part of these media organizations, if you've ever visited a broadcaster, are occupying, you know, rooms of this size of equipment and gear that isn't possible right now to put into the cloud. So, you know, the big expense of these media organizations is still about delivering to their regular, you know, 6 o'clock news at 6 o'clock customers, not the kids watching it on YouTube or whatever else. It will change, and it's changing, but I don't think it's changing as fast as everybody had thought. So, you know, they all have to do it, and you need to get the brand out there, and you need to be on Netflix and iTunes and YouTube and Vimeo and whatever else, but they know that they're not making a lot of money out of that. So the lack of investment potentially is tempered by that fact and that truth. So, you know, I think that there are a lot of customers that are becoming a lot of media owners that are becoming very aggressive about their OTT type deliverables. But it's not really today where the money is, but it will change, and it has been changing slower, I think, than everybody anticipated.
Yeah.
Jason, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I feel like from the point YouTube was acquired back in, what was that, 2008, 2009, until today, we've been in a state of almost consolidation of the technology stack that powers the consumer side of things. And what I mean by that is there are industry giants who are working towards building the best of breed solutions that it's easy for you know, vendors like us to be able to provide very powerful, very scalable, over-the-top, consumer-focused streaming solutions, streaming video. So from that perspective, I feel like we're in a good spot right now where there's not a huge amount of change, and we're able to anticipate the change and have enough, you know, time to really get at it without having to build the fundamental layer and hope that our solution succeeds. So from that perspective, I think we're in a good spot. You know, things do change at this point, but I think the rate of change is definitely slower than it was in like 2008, 2009, 2010. So we're in a generally good spot from streaming a video to consumers.
And finally, when we look at analysis of viewership or listenership, or in the case of games, their usage by consumers, how are cloud-based and big data solutions coming into play? How is this impacting the traditional audience measurement systems? Brian?
That's a good question. So I think actually Nielsen, which is, you know, the one that everybody's familiar with if you're 150 years old or something like that, they just last year, I think, launched their online platforms. Google has their own Google Analytics that sits around YouTube. All of the OTT OVP platforms have their own metrics and analytics engines and ad insertion engines and things like that. So I think the data is out there. It's just fragmented per service. So, you know, maybe having all of that in a consolidated environment is a good thing. But what's actually happening is a lot of broadcasters, therefore, or content owners, are forced to distribute out through 15 different platforms and tools to 100 different end consumer and target devices around the world. They have people on staff that are, you know, writing code to pull the metrics from here and there and stitch everything together and figure out what their CPMs are and figure out what their advertisers are paying per, you know, commercial spot run and things like that. I mean, Google's got it down with the YouTube thing, and, you know, I think the other services like that are making money out of this have done a good job. I've heard a lot of horror stories inside of media companies where they basically say, you know, we want the broadcaster, Ford Motor Company or whomever else, to broadcast on our linear channels, and the deal closer is, and we'll give you carriage on all of our properties online. And I mean, it's not something that's usually a billable thing. Now, when you're talking about World Cup and Super Bowl, that's a different story. But for just general run-of-the-mill stuff, I think a lot of that is I don't want to say throwaway, because it almost seems like it's minimizing it. It's an extremely important platform for these content owners to deliver to. But again, it's not where the money is today.
Yeah. I feel that for an individual service, capturing and processing and providing that data back as a reporting function is very doable. Mm-hmm. You know, all of us here do that today, and it's every software as a service solution pretty much has the expectation of having to do that. So from that perspective, it's easy, and the challenge comes, as Brian says, is when you have to reconcile between two disparate systems. Mm. And that's a problem that won't be solved.
Or 10 systems.
Or 10 systems, which right? Is worse. It becomes exponentially harder. So I feel bad for the people who have to do that.
Interns. Interns throw more interns.
I'm glad I'm not that person.
I think that's spot on. So, you know, we've been working with a major broadcaster for a while, and we did their desktop video solution. This is just in the video player alone, not including the page and so forth. We integrated, I think, 7 different analytic providers. Mm. And it actually starts to become an issue. Like, you have implications of doing that this app does make so many HTTP requests all the time, let alone it's trying to play back, you know, high quality video. And that to me is the biggest concern. Like, the need of data is incredible. The value of data, the monetary value of that data, also incredibly valuable, especially as things start shifting to that. They're actually going to make money on the web more so, and that audience shifts to that, and that business model shifts as well. But it's a massive mess right now, because there is such different disparate systems in there that everyone can easily be sold on, and to seemingly some degree, that, we really want them. I really hope that in the future, the cloud type of solutions with that analytic do start to find a better way to, migrate and merge into a more unified process for that, and I think that is going to be a challenge. Otherwise, right now it's a very competitive market in there, but it's not the type of thing like, well, you just have to choose one. It's just kind of, we'll throw them all at it and we'll see what we like. Mm-hmm. So it's still valuable, it's still going to happen, but right now it's not pretty. And honestly, it's a common occurrence. I mean, we really most times see multiple analytic integrations in there. And these are things that pull quite detailed bits of information, but it just never seems to be enough. Once you're hooked on it, you just want more.
So, do we have any questions from the audience? Not one? Well, thank you, all three of you, very much.
Thank you. Thank you.